common misconceptions regarding some miscellaneous issues. We now come to the first of them, and that is regarding the prohibition of songs and music. It is generally believed that the attitude of Islam towards the fine arts is not very encouraging. It does not nurture the aesthetic sense found in human nature. Thus, for example, it totally prohibits singing and music. Unfortunately, this view is not consistent with the sources of Islam. In this regard, it is necessary to keep in consideration two important principles of interpreting the Sharia. Firstly, it is only the Quran which prohibits anything in Islam. As far as the Ahadith are concerned, they only explain something alluded to by the Quran or state the corollary of some principle mentioned in the Quran or describe the exemplary way of how the Prophet Muhammad followed Islam. They are not an independent source of Islam and must have some basis in the Quran, the Sunnah, or the established principles of sense and reason. Consequently, if some ahadith mention the prohibition of something, it is imperative to look up its basis in the original sources. Secondly, if a particular matter has been elaborated upon in the ahadith, it is necessary to have a complete picture of it by collecting and analyzing all the ahadith on the subject. This is essential in order to have some idea of the context and background of what actually has been said or implied. In the light of these two principles, it is evident that, number one, as far as the Quran is concerned, there is no mention of any absolute prohibition of music. On the contrary, it is a known fact that one of the other divinely revealed scriptures, the Psalms of David, is basically a collection of hymns. The Prophet David sallallahu alaihi wasallam used to sing the various psalms revealed to him on his harp. The psalms mention, "Come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation." Psalm 95, verse 1. Similarly, it is said, "Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth." Psalm number 96, verse 1. And still another example is, "I will sing a new song to you, O God. On the 10-string lyre, I will make music to you." Psalm number 144, verse 9. The Quran refers to this in the following words, وَسَخَّرْنَا مَعَ دَاوُدَ الْجِبَالَ يُسَبِّحْنَا وَالطَّيْرَ وَكُنَّا فَاعِلِينَ. And we caused the mountains and the birds to join with David in singing our praise. And all these things could have been done only by us. Surah number 21, verse 79. Number 2. If the Quran does not apparently mention this absolute prohibition, it is necessary to reanalyze all the ahadith on this subject to see whether they have been interpreted correctly. If all the ahadith pertaining to music are examined, the real picture which comes to light is that musical gatherings possessed various objectionable elements in them. The most prominent among them included lewdness and liquor consumption. Slave girls used to dance before inebriated gatherings where lewdness was let loose and promiscuity prevailed. They were a means of stimulating base emotions in people. There has been narrated in the Sahih of Imam Bukhari one such incident from which the extent such gatherings of music and dance had reached can be imagined. It took place right after the Battle of Badr. Hussein ibn Ali reported that Ali radiallahu anhu said, "From among the spoils of Badr, a she-camel was given to me as my share. Besides her, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam also gave me another she-camel from the gains of Khums. When my marriage was decided with Fatima radiallahu anha, the daughter of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, I made a deal with a goldsmith belonging to the tribe of Qainuqa that he would go with me to bring a special type of grass by loading it on the camels. By selling this grass to the goldsmiths, I wanted to throw my walima. For this, I arranged for ropes and pack saddle for my she-camels. These camels were sitting in the house of a person from the Ansar tribe. After gathering these things, I went to the camels. I saw that someone had chopped off their humps and taken out their livers by cutting open their stomachs. I could not restrain my tears at this situation. I asked people, 'Who is responsible for this?' They replied, 'Hamza ibn Abdul Muttalib. He is drinking liquor in this house along with many people of the Ansar. A songstress is also present there along with his friends.' What happened was that when she sang the following words, 'Hamza, get up and slay these robust she-camels,' he immediately pounced on them with the sword and chopped off their humps and took out their livers by slicing open their stomachs. Al-Bukhari, Al-Jami' al-Sahih, Volume 4, page 1470, Hadith number 3781. In other words, musical gatherings were not disallowed per se. It was because of these forbidden elements found in them that they were forbidden. Thus, in some narratives, musical instruments are censured because of this aspect. They were used in gatherings which were vulgar and lecherous. Their positive use was never forbidden. We find narratives which show that such music and songs were not disallowed by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Urwa reports from Aisha radhiyallahu ta'ala anha, "The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam once came over to me. On this occasion, two slave girls were singing the songs related to the Battle of Bu'ath. He lay down on a bed and turned himself to the other side. In the meantime, Abu Bakr came along and scolded me for what was going on and said, 'Why are these devilish musical instruments in the presence of the Prophet?' The Prophet turned and said, 'Leave them alone and let them sing.' When Abu Bakr got involved in some work, I gestured towards these songstresses to go away. So they went away. This was the day of Eid." Al-Bukhari, Al-Jami' al-Sahih, Volume 1, page 323, Hadith number 907. It is evident from the above narrative that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam did not prohibit singing and music on the occasion of Eid. Not only did he not express any resentment on the two slave girls singing, he even stopped Abu Bakr radiyallahu ta'ala anhu from asking them to discontinue. Ar-Rabi bint Mu'az said, "When I departed as a bride to my husband's house, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam came over to me and sat on my bedding the way you are sitting on it. At this time, our slave girls were singing an elegy to the martyrs of Badr on a small tambourine. On this occasion, one of the slave girls, while singing, said the words, 'Present among us is the Prophet who knows what is going to happen in the future.' At this, the Prophet said, 'Do not say this, but sing what you were singing before.'" Al-Bukhari, Al-Jami' al-Sahih, Volume 4, page 323, Hadith number 3779. It is evident from some narratives that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam had kept a person called Anjasha, who was a camel driver, who would sing marching tunes to boost the speed of the camels. During one journey, when these camels were impelled to trudge faster by his chants, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam lovingly chided him that he should think of the women riding the camels, lest they should fall down because of their fast speed. Anas reported that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam had a camel driver called Anjasha, and he had a very melodious voice. In one journey, the Prophet said to him, "Sing slowly, O Anjasha, lest you might break these delicate crystals." Qatada clarified that this refers to delicate women. Al-Bukhari, Al-Jami' al-Sahih, Volume 5, page 2294, Hadith number 5857. In the light of this analysis, the prohibition of music can be easily understood. Only music and songs which possessed an element of immorality in them had been forbidden. Music, it is clear, was not condemned because of any intrinsic evil in it, but because it was responsible for stimulating base sentiments in a person. The main object of the religion revealed to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was to cleanse and purify human souls from evil. All means which promote base emotions in people certainly could not be allowed in the society. He therefore strongly took exception to the gatherings of music and dance in order to rebuild the society on healthy lines. In short, the prohibition of music and songs pertains to a few specific forms of this art. If they are not vulgar and lewd in nature, they cannot be regarded as forbidden. We now come to the second misconception, and that is regarding istikhara and dreams. People generally think that istikhara is a sure short way to find out the will of God in a particular matter. For this, they even go to professional istikhara doers. It needs to be realized that istikhara is nothing but a supplication or a dua to God. It asks God to guide us in matters in which it is difficult for us to take a decision. One can see how powerful and potent is this prophetic supplication from its words. "O God, I seek what is better through your knowledge, and through your might I seek strength and beg from you your great blessings, because you have the might and I do not have the might. And you know everything and I do not know, and you have knowledge of the unseen. O God, if in your knowledge this action which I intend to do is better with regard to my religion, my life, and my fate, then destine it for me and make it easy for me, and then add blessings to it for me. And O God, in your knowledge, if this action is bad for me, for my religion, and for my fate, then turn it away from me and turn me away from it. And O God, whatever is better for me, ordain that for me, wherever it is, and then make me satisfied with it. Al-Bukhari, Al-Jami As-Sahih, Volume 1, page 391, Hadith number 1109. Now, like every supplication, the Almighty either positively responds to it through some indication, or there can be times when He defers action on it depending upon His wisdom. Thus, it needs to be realized that the istikhara is no more than a supplication or a dua, and is not a formula to find out the will of God. Moreover, people generally think that only through dreams does one get an indication of God's will after doing istikhara. It is because of this misconception that they think that an indication through a dream is the only way to know the Almighty's will in a particular matter. Actually, there are a number of ways in which this indication can come, if at all. Dreams are just one of these. There may be several ways. For example, circumstances sometimes become more clear so that a person is able to judge for himself. Similarly, someone might just come along and help a person in his decision. Likewise, the Almighty may directly guide a person by giving him an inner indication. However, whatever be the source, it is imperative that an indication which is against divine revelation and sense and reason should not be accepted. One should always act according to one's common sense, since this sense is the foremost guidance provided by the Almighty to man. Generally, dreams help us in deciding when there is an indication from no other source. Again, what is interpreted from them should not refute knowledge, common sense, or experience if it is to be accepted. And if it does refute any of these bases, then that interpretation must be ignored. We now come to the third misconception, and that is regarding the return of Jesus sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Muslims generally believe that near the end of this world, Jesus sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who was lifted alive from this earth, will reappear, and this reappearance will actually be a sign of the coming of the Day of Judgment. While critically analyzing this issue, Javed Ahmed Ghamidi writes, "As far as the narratives which record the advent of Jesus are concerned, though the Muhaddithun have generally accepted them, however, if they are analyzed in the light of the Quran, they too become dubious. Firstly, the personality of Jesus sallallahu alaihi wasallam has been discussed in the Quran from various aspects. The Quran has commented on his dawah mission and his personality at a lot of places. The cataclysm that will take place on the Day of Judgment is also a very frequently discussed topic of the Quran. The advent of a celebrated prophet of God from the heavens is no small an incident. In spite of the fact that there were many instances in which this incident could have been mentioned, we find that there is not a single place in which it is mentioned in the Quran. Can human knowledge and intellect be satisfied with this silence? One does find this hard to digest. Secondly, the Quran has recorded a dialogue of God with Jesus sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which will take place on the Day of Judgment. During the course of this conversation, the Almighty will ask him about the real affair in which the Christians had gone astray, which is the divinity of Jesus and Mary. He will ask Jesus sallallahu alaihi wasallam if it was as per his instructions that he had told people to deify himself and his mother whilst leaving aside God. In response to this question, among other things, Jesus will say that he instructed his people in the very manner he was asked by God, and that as long as he remained among them, he watched over what they were doing, and that after his own demise, he was not aware of what good or evil they did, and that after his death, it was God who watched over them. In this dialogue, one can clearly feel that the last sentence is very inappropriate if Jesus sallallahu alaihi wasallam had also come in this world a second time. In such a case, he should have responded by saying that he knew what happened with them, and that little earlier he had gone to warn them of their grievous faults. The Quran says, مَا قُلْتُ لَهُمْ إِلَّا مَا أَمَرْتَنِي بِهِ أَنْ يَعْبُدُ اللَّهَ رَبِّي وَرَبَّكُمْ وَكُنْتُ عَلَيْهِمْ شَهِيدًا مَا دُمْتُ فِيهِمْ فَلَمَّا تَوَفَّيْتَنِي كُنْتَ أَنْتَ الرَّقِيبَ عَلَيْهِمْ وَأَنْتَ عَلَىٰ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ شَهِيدٍ Never did I say to them except what you commanded me to do, and that is, worship God my Lord and your Lord. And I was a witness over them while I dwelt with them. When you gave death to me, you were the watcher over them, and you are a witness over all things. Surah number 5, verse 117. Thirdly, in one verse of the Quran, the Almighty has disclosed what will happen to Jesus sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his followers till the day of judgment. Since in recent demand that here he should have also disclosed his second coming before the advent of this day. However, we find no such mention. If Jesus sallallahu alaihi wasallam had to come, why was silence maintained at this instance? One is unable to comprehend any reason for it. The verse is, إِنِّي مُتَوَفِّيكَ وَرَافِعُكَ إِلَيَّ وَمُتَهِّرُكَ مِنَ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا وَجَعِلُ الَّذِينَ اتَّبَعُوكَ فَوْقَ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا إِلَىٰ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ ثُمَّ إِلَيَّ مَرْجِعُكُمْ فَأَحْكُمُ بَيْنَكُمْ فِي مَا كُنْتُمْ فِيهِ تَخْتَلِفُونَ O Jesus, I have decided to give death to you and raise you to myself and cleanse you from these people who have denied you. I shall make those who follow you superior to those who reject faith till the day of judgment. Then to me you shall all return, and I shall give my verdict in what you have been differing. Surah number 3, verse 55. We now come to the fourth misconception, and that is regarding fate and predestination. Some Muslims believe that their fate has been pre-written. If this is so, then why will people be sent to hell for deeds which were written down beforehand and they could do nothing about them? Also, what is the purpose of dua when it cannot change predetermined fates? In this regard, if the following points of clarification are kept in mind, they may prove helpful in removing the confusion which in general seems to surround this concept of predestination. 1. The Almighty has given us the free will to select between good and evil. If a person intends to adopt the right path, it is up to him. And if he intends to adopt the wrong path, it is entirely his choice. It is after this liberty given to us in exercising our intention that the Almighty will reward or punish us. This retribution, therefore, will be based on our own deeds and not under any compulsion of fate. 2. Whatever is written down about our fate concerns God's knowledge about our fate. His prior knowledge does not mean that we are under any compulsion to do what has been written down. It only means that he knows what we are going to do. Consequently, if God knows beforehand that such and such people will go to hell or certain others will go to heaven, then it only means that such people will do the deeds which will lead them to a bad fate. In other words, a person's deeds will determine his fate only. However, what deeds he will do are already in the knowledge of God. 3. Dua has a great significance since it is an expression of Tawheed. There are things which will be given to us if we only ask for them, otherwise we will not receive them. In other words, they are dependent upon dua, so one cannot and should not disregard it. We now come to the fifth misconception, and that is regarding the prohibition of portraits and pictures. It is believed that Islam prohibits making pictures of living beings. Unfortunately, the stance of Islam on this issue has been grossly misunderstood. It is not true that Islam prohibits pictures and portraits in the absolute sense. Only pictures which cultivate sentiments of worship in people are prohibited. Thus, we see that not only does the Quran not mention any such prohibition, it in fact praises the pictures and sculptures made by the Prophet Solomon sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Had there been any issue or prohibition with them, it would certainly have condemned this act. The Quran states, يَعْمَلُونَ لَهُ مَا يَشَاءُ مِنْ مَحَارِيبَ وَتَمَاثِيلَ وَجِفَانٍ كَالْجَوَابِ وَقُدُورِ الرَّاسِيَاتِ اعْمَلُوا آلَ دَاوُودَ شُكْرًا وَقَلِيلٌ مِنْ عِبَادِيَ الشَّكُورِ They made for him whatever he pleased, shrines in tamasil, and basins as large as watering troughs, and built in cauldrons. We said, act with gratitude, house of David. Yet few of my servants are truly thankful. Surah number 34, verse 13. It needs to be appreciated that the word tamasil used in this verse is the plural of timsal and denotes portraits and statues, both of living and non-living beings. We find more detail in the Bible regarding the portraits and statues placed in the Temple of Solomon. It is recorded, in the inner sanctuary he made a pair of cherubim of olive wood, each 10 cubits high. One wing of the first cherub was 5 cubits long, and the other wing 5 cubits. 10 cubits from wingtip to wingtip. The second cherub also measured 10 cubits, for the two cherubim were identical in size and shape. The height of each cherub was 10 cubits. He placed the cherubim inside the innermost room of the temple with their wings spread out. The wing of one cherub touched one wall while the wing of the other touched the other wall, and their wings touched each other in the middle of the room. He overlaid the cherubim with gold. On the walls all around the temple, in both the inner and outer rooms, he carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. 1 Kings chapter 6, verses 23 to 29. Furthermore, it is also recorded, he also made 10 movable stands of bronze. Each was 4 cubits long, 4 wide, and 3 high. This is how the stands were made. They had side panels attached to uprights. 1 Kings chapter 7, verses 27 to 28. At still another place, the words are, the face of a man toward the palm tree on one side, and the face of a lion toward the palm tree on the other. They were carved all around the whole temple. From the floor to the area above the entrance, cherubim and palm trees were carved on the wall of the outer sanctuary. The outer sanctuary had a rectangular door frame, and the one at the front of the most holy place was similar. Ezekiel chapter 41, verses 19 to 21. It is thus clear that the Quran does not prohibit portrait and images in the absolute sense. The source of this prohibition are certain ahadith. By collecting and analyzing all these ahadith, the complete picture which emerges is that a particular category of pictures and portraits had acquired the status of idols and were worshipped. They were regarded as deities by the people of Arabia. As such, they used to consider them alive and capable of granting them their wishes. They used to bow down before them in adoration. There were many sacred pictures drawn on the walls, columns, and the roof of the Kaaba, as a study of its history reveals. Consequently, there is mention of the fact that the portraits of Abraham, Jesus, and Mary were sketched on its columns. In the light of these details, the prohibition of portraits can easily be understood. Only portraits which possess religious sanctity and lead people into worshipping them are prohibited. Pictures, photographs, and image-making, it is clear, is not condemned because of any intrinsic evil in them, but because they contribute to polytheistic tendencies of people. The Quran regards monotheism as the fundamental article of faith, and the Prophet Muhammad considered his duty to eliminate any traces of polytheism in the society. Therefore, he ordered for the elimination of portraits and images which had assumed the status of gods. Consequently, if these ahadith are carefully studied, the words which cannot be missed are such pictures and these pictures, which point only to a certain type of portraits and not to all forms. In this regard, another hadith often quoted in support of their total and unconditional prohibition has also not been interpreted correctly. The words of the Prophet Muhammad as quoted in the Sahih of Al-Bukhari are, Abdullah ibn Umar reports from the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, indeed, creators of such pictures will be punished on the day of judgment, and it will be said to them, inject life in what you have created. Al-Bukhari, Al-Jami, Al-Sahih, Volume 5, page 2220, Hadith number 5607. These words actually point to what has been stated earlier. People used to regard these images as living beings and as such used to invoke their help. The hadith warns such people and says that those who believe that these images are living creatures and will save them on the day of judgment from the wrath of the Almighty shall actually be asked to inject life in them on that day to redeem them of their punishment. This demand, of course, will only be meant to add insult to injury. It is therefore evident that the prohibition of pictures and portraits pertains to a specific form. If the art of image-making and sculpturing does not cultivate the sentiments of worship towards something, then it is certainly not disallowed. Islam has no objection against photographs, which today have become a social need as well in the form of identity cards, passports, etc., whether they are made by a still camera or a video camera. Similarly, pictures of one's relatives and family bear no label of prohibition.